Good morning. Slight change of plan. I'll finish the introduction first, and then we'll have a period, for those who want to stay, for discussion and clarification of the introductory section, last night and now. Because unless this introductory part is clear, really we can't usefully study the book of Exodus. So last evening we ended with this statement here. And you've got the picture of Canaan, and the shadowed parts are the 12 tribes that you hear a lot about. And the comment here is, the oldest extant record of the existence of a people called Israel is an Egyptian stone inscription from the time of Merneptah, the end of the 13th century. He's the son of the famous Ramses II. Israel Finkelstein writes, evidence of an increase in settlement in the highlands of Canaan in the 13th century. And he writes, the vast majority of the people who settled in the hill country and in the Transjordan during the Iron One period must have been indigenous. So, the conclusions from archaeology are irrefutable, really. These people here in the so-called tribes of Jacob, of Israel, were people who lived in this area. And their parents lived in the area, and their grandparents, and their great-grandparents. That's their home. That's where they belonged. They were pushed up into the hill country here because it was inaccessible a bit to the chariots and so on by the invasion of the sea peoples about whom we have evidence at this time. So they're pushed, including the Philistines, one group. So they're pushed up into here, and they were locals. They didn't come from Egypt with Moses through the desert and then come in and kill everybody in here and take over. Historically, that didn't happen. Now, the settlements were not fortified, and they can work that out archaeologically. They lived a simple lifestyle, and their settling in the hill country was peaceful. Archaeology reveals earlier similar settlements in the highlands of Canaan. The first was about 3,500 BC, and they've discovered 100 sites for that groupings of people. The second was about 2,000 BC, and they've discovered 220 sites. And the people that we call Israel represent the third such attempt at subsistence farming in the hill country. Now, these settlers belong to a number of different tribes. The largest tribe was that of Joseph, so large that it was Ephraim, Manasseh, they're both the sons of Joseph in the story of the book of Genesis. So that's the Joseph peoples, and they even pressed over and stretched into this part on the east of the Jordan River. So they're certainly the biggest tribe of Jacob. Now, with the small tribe of Benjamin, which is just here wedged in between the tribes of Joseph and Judah, wedged in there. And in the story, of course, these Joseph and Benjamin were the favourite sons of Jacob and the children of Rachel. So there, that's the story, is built up around them. The Joseph tribes occupied the hill country and Manasseh spilled over, and the tribe of Judah occupied the southern highlands. The tribes of Reuben and Gad occupied the mountain region east of the Jordan. Reuben and Gad here. The smaller tribes of Simeon and Dan, Simeon was here, but it eventually vanished into Judah, and Dan was this little tiny area here, originally, west of Benjamin. That didn't last long either. Under pressure from the Philistines, the tribe of Dan, Philistines are just here, you see. So the tribe of Dan migrated right up here to the north, a part that was unoccupied. North of the valley of Esdraelon in the highlands of Galilee, where the tribes of Issachar, Zebulun, Naphtali and Asher, here they are here. The four tribes of what we'll call Galilee. These tribes inhabited the mountainous region of Canaan, and the thorough and extensive archaeological surveys carried out since 1967 reveal a culture different from that of the city-states and the agricultural lands of the coastal plain and lowlands. The Israelites were herders who had turned to farming when the collapse of law and order in the lowlands meant that they could no longer rely on traditional barter. So they had to get their own. They were basically herders, but they had to do some agriculture. They had to provide their own grain on the eastern highlands, facing in towards the Jordan, and on the western highlands they had their vineyards. Now, the key historical question is, where did the highland tribes hear about and embrace the worship of Yahweh? That is the critical question. Where did the highlands tribes hear about Yahweh and embrace the religion of Yahweh? The answer given in the Bible tells of a group of slaves who escaped from Egypt and, after journeying in the Sinai desert, crossed the Jordan River and entered Canaan from the east. The books of the Bible that tell this story, namely the book of Exodus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, form the heart of the Old Testament. In them we have story rather than history, as we would use the term. But the stories and legends draw on a long oral tradition, and they express the essential identity of these tribes, their religious identity. As the story goes, this group originated in Canaan. Well, they all know that. Look at the story of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob and Joseph in Genesis. But had been enslaved in Egypt and had escaped under the leadership of a man called Moses. And while you're looking at the name Moses, put R.A. at the front and you get Ramses. That's not his name, Moses. We're not saying it was Ramses. It might have been Hatibses. But the Mzuz at the end means son of. So obviously the historical name, the legendary name, had originally on the front of it, because that's not even a name. It's like Johnson, Abrahamson. Well, this is just the son bit. Something's been lost. And probably it's an Egyptian god. So they obviously dropped it out. So Moses, with an Egyptian name, led them out. They were formed into a people during their years in the Sinai desert and had a unique understanding of God as being the God of the oppressed. The religion of Israel is unique in the ancient world. All the other countries, the God was the God of the king, the God of the leaders, the God of the rich, the God of the powerful, the God of the mountains. You got it? That was their gods, all of them. Marduk was the god of Babylon and so on. Israel, the God of Israel, is the God of the poor, the widowed, the oppressed, the lonely, the strangers, the slaves. It was a complete and a wonderful reversal, which Jesus took even further, but a wonderful reversal of religious insight as to who is God and what really matters. The biblical text, which we're going to start on this morning, is liturgical. It's exhortatory and it's dramatic. Brackets. Just imagine you probably go to the Easter Vigil sometimes. All right. Well, the Easter Vigil isn't a reenactment of what happened on the day of the resurrection. I mean, you have all your ceremonies and everyone in the parish is involved and you have liturgy readings and you have someone singing the Exultet. Well, that wasn't sung at the time of the Exodus, you know. The Exultet wasn't. So it's a liturgical text which helps people now, if it's done well, be engaged in the resurrection event. Jesus is rising for them, for us, at the end of Lent. And so the text, however, is powerful and it's dramatic. And it's quite wonderful, and sometimes these days you have PowerPoints and the creation of the world and all that, and it invites you in through story about an event, of course, the resurrection of Jesus. The lack of corroboration from outside the Bible, in other words, there's no evidence of Moses, there's no evidence of the people escaping, there's no evidence of them leaving any traces in the wilderness at all. So we're not, and Egypt doesn't talk about it. No other country talks about it. It's only in the Bible. So the lack of corroboration from outside the Bible is no reason to doubt that there was a historical kernel that is the source of the Moses narratives and are central to the Torah. It was, perhaps, a small group of the enslaved Habiru, Hebrew, led by Moses, who made their escape into the Sinai Peninsula at this time. But they weren't a massive group. And it's that group that pick up this new idea of God and bring it in to the tribes that are already there. Not being strong enough, this group of escaped people, we can't prove it, but it's in the Bible, and it's so dense, it's so important there that clearly it's based on a tradition that goes way, way back among these people. Not being strong enough to force their way north, this group of escaped slaves spent a generation wandering the desert lands till they were able to enter Canaan from the east across the Jordan. During this long desert experience, they formed into a religious community, bound together not by race or geography, but by their commitment to each other and to God under the name of Yahweh, the liberator God whom they believed was responsible for their miraculous escape. It was they who introduced the cult of Yahweh to the highland tribes. So they came in with a new idea of God, and the new idea of God appealed to these people in the highlands because they were oppressed, they were enslaved, inverted commas, they were poor, they were the lowest of the low in a sense, and that God would be caring for them was encouraging and made sense to them, and many of them converted to this new idea of God. Because the ideas of God that were around them were always the God of the oppressor, the leader, the king, the dominating cultural group. The tribes of Israel committed themselves to organize their communities on the principles of justice that followed from worshipping a God who hears the cry of the poor. And you're going to find many beautiful things in the book of Exodus, and other places, but we're studying Exodus, that are about caring for the poor, caring for the oppressed, caring for the widow and the orphan, and so on. Now, decisions in this new emerging, it's not a monarchy yet, but tribal groupings, decisions were supposed to be made not by custom, for custom benefited the status quo and proved ineffectual as an instrument of justice. The decisions were supposed to be made not by authoritarian law enacted by the powerful, that's never going to work for the poor, not by so-called wisdom, which, as practiced, was a form of self-interested know-how for the benefit of those who were influential. Not by necromancy, calling up the dead to tell us what to do. Not by fate, not by chance or random superstition. All of that existed all around them. That was not the source of their decisions. What the source of their way of making decisions was, remembering the deeds of Yahweh and listening to Yahweh's voice coming to them through particularly spiritual people, men or women, prophets, inverted commas, who spoke out of their passion for truth and justice and kept inviting the community to live by these principles. Since we were once slaves in Egypt, we all weren't, but we are religiously, do you get it? Coming from them. So just as that, well, we shouldn't be enslaving people and we shouldn't be doing this and we should do this, etc., etc. Success was to be measured not by the achievements of personal kudos, but by what gave glory to Yahweh. That is to say, by what attracted people to praise this God of theirs, this God of the poor, Yahweh, and his action in favor of his people. The land belonged to Yahweh. Yahweh gave it to them. And in all the writings, you see, we didn't win it by our own power. Well, they didn't win it at all. But we didn't win it by our own power. God gave it to us. And as they saw it, God got rid of all the people in the land through the instruments of Joshua and the rest of them, slaughtering them all, a bit like the ISIS now in those parts of the world. That's how they imagined it, but they imagined it wrongly. But their key point was, it's not our land, it's God's land, we've got to obey God. The land belonged to Yahweh and so could be used only so long as the occupants were faithful to Yahweh. Brackets again, and you'll recall later on when they were forced out of the land by the Assyrians first in the north and then by the Babylonians at the time of the Babylonian exile, they thought, well, we've done something wrong. God has punished us because we didn't follow God's law. Do you follow the logic? They had this, it comes all the way through the Old Testament scriptures, right up to the time of Jesus. It was assumed, and you've got to get this clear in your minds too, there are certain assumptions in all the writers. Now, if God's going to inspire someone to write or to speak, he has to inspire a real person. So they're going to be limited. And they're going to be limited with their language, they're limited with their overworld. It's not a dictation process. God is inspiring real people. So the real people had certain assumptions in their mind right through. One was that everything that happens is organized by God. Now, you don't have that assumption, I hope. I certainly don't have it. And we can't have it. Because there's such a thing as sin that's very difficult to understand. People disobey God, and what they do can't be said to be produced by God. Do you get it? It comes out of refusal to listen to God. It comes out of sin. So that what happens in our world is a mixture of people listening to grace and doing beautiful things and other people resisting grace and doing ugly things. So that's our way. But for them, everything came from God. So if the people in Judah lost the battle against the Babylonians, they didn't think it's because the Babylonians had more soldiers and more ammunition. which is what we'd think. They didn't think that. They thought, no, God raised up Nebuchadnezzar in from Babylon to come over and take over our country. God organized it to punish us for doing something wrong. What did we do wrong? We intermarried, we didn't follow the laws, we didn't properly obey God, and hence the writings were, no, you should have got rid of all the Canaanites. You should have done what God told you to do and killed them all. And, you know, get it? It's kind of warped logic, but that's the logic they had, and that's all in the Bible as we read it now. So, without jumping ahead too much, you have to do, and I have to do something. Every time we open the Old Testament texts, we've got to have Jesus sitting beside us. And he is saying to you, tapping you on the shoulder, it was said to you of old, but I say to you. Well, you heard Jesus say that quite often. It was said to you of old, love your neighbour and hate your enemy, but I say love your enemies. So Jesus' idea of God was very different from any of the ideas of God that preceded him. And the people that preceded him are precisely the people whose writings we're studying. So we've got to pull back a bit. We've got to read the Old Testament through Jesus' eyes, or we'll get it wrong. And we'll end up doing what the people who knew the Bible best did. They crucified Jesus because he didn't fit their view of God or of punishment or of life or of anything much. I mean, he ate with sinners, didn't he? And he said to the woman in adultery, I don't condemn you, don't do it again, but I don't condemn you. And you know the stories of the gospel. It's a bit frightening to people who've got this very long traditional idea of their God. Much of it's beautiful, the liberator, the carer for the poor, but there's another side to the God of the Old Testament that isn't beautiful, and it's mixed up, and we've got to... Now, according to the book of Joshua, the end of chapter 24, the tribes met, these 12 tribes, when things were getting grim, when the Philistines were starting to come up into the highlands and attack them again, and they were pretty defenseless. So they met at a place called Shechem here, in the middle. There was a meeting of these tribes, or representatives of them, I'm not sure, you can't tell. The various tribal ancestral legends were shared. So each tribe had its own sacred site. There's a site down here, there's a site there, there's a site up in here and there. They've all got their own little place, like the sacred sites of the Aboriginal groups in Australia. They've got their sacred sites, each group. Well, they had them too. And that's where their stories developed there and were told there by the priests in the sanctuaries and remembered there. And when they all came together, they shared their stories. So they ended up with Abraham being the father of Isaac, and Isaac was the father of Jacob. Well, that's not historical, but they gathered their stories and they linked them so that they're all our stories now, not just the stories of Issachar or the stories of Judah about Abraham or the stories of Shechem, which were about Joseph, and so on. The legends were shared, and the story of the Exodus was told and retold, and it gets better in the telling. Writing was a rare phenomenon in the peasant community where trade was mostly by exchange. Welcome. Good. Traditions were handed on in oral form. Religious traditions found expression, especially in liturgical forms that were committed to memory by usage. They didn't have written texts, they didn't have books like we've got with all the rituals. It was all remembered and done and adapted without even being noticed. In these traditions, which were later written down, and now we read of them, once they're written, they become a bit fixed, and we can read it in the written text of the Bible. Remembering that the story of Moses was 700 years before the writing about him. So that's a lot of time. A lot of time for development and interest and so on. Knowledge of the oral origins of the material warns us against reading the biblical narratives outside such a context. As you read it, you've got to imagine yourself sitting around a fire, if you like, having stories told by grandpa or grandma, and they're telling these stories, and others are coming in and say, yeah, that happened to us too. And so it's in a lively communication stuff. We can be confident that we're reading material which puts us in touch with truth, so long as we recognise that it's the truth of religious experience expressed in the ritual language of the cult, not a historical record picked up from a video. So that's Shechem, the central. So you see, at this time, it was only quite later, Jerusalem here, which is at the south of Benjamin, on the border between Benjamin and Judah, Jerusalem was only captured by King David in the year 1000, so that Jerusalem's still owned by the Jebusites, and they couldn't get into it because it had walls and so on. So Shechem was the main centre. In the book of Joshua, chapter 24, verse 1, we read, Joshua gathered all the tribes of Israel to Shechem, and he summoned the elders, the heads, the judges, and the officers of Israel, and they presented themselves before God. Joshua recalls the story of the patriarchs, our story now of all the different tribes, and he continues, and I'll read the text, Joshua 24, verses 4 to 7. Jacob and his children, this is written down many years later, of course, so whoever wrote it was trying to recapture the moment. Joshua and his children went down to Egypt. Then I, God, sent Moses and Aaron, and I plagued Egypt with what I did in their midst. And afterwards I, Yahweh, brought you out. When I brought your ancestors out of Egypt, you came to the sea, and the Egyptians pursued your ancestors with chariots and horsemen into the Red Sea. When they cried out to Yahweh, he put darkness between you and the Egyptians and made the sea come upon them and cover them, and your eyes saw what I did to Egypt. Afterwards you lived in the wilderness a long time. This is God speaking through Joshua in 1200 BC. Now, a book by Gottwald called The Hebrew Bible, this is interesting, I hope I can communicate it clearly, suggests that the Exodus story functioned as an umbrella metaphor for tribal Israel. It covers everything. Let's go through it slowly. A people oppressed by kings unites to escape from physical and mental bondage to the oppressor. That's exactly what the tribes had to do when they came from the lowlands up into the hill country. So the story of slaves being oppressed by Egypt, and Egypt was the main person behind, the main country behind all these city-states that were doing the oppressing, not the sea peoples but the others, well, that story fitted them. So it made them feel at home with their history. Two, a people freed from an imposed social order unites and experiments to create a tribal, intertribal community. And that's what they were doing in the highlands. Well, that's what Moses and the escaped people did in the desert. A people whose leaders had been imposed now struggles to create necessary leadership in the absence of coercive state power. How do we build up our tribal identity, and who runs it, and what kind of leaders do we need, because it's no longer being determined by the oppressing city-state that was organised from Egypt. A people threatened by disease and plague struggles to reproduce and preserve itself by adequate hygienic measures. So we're going to read in the book of stuff about lepers, and we're going to read laws and things which were early medicine, early hygiene to try and preserve when they were because they were dependent on the rain. They had months and months of dry season, and there could be all kinds of problems arising. The Exodus story would have encouraged the northern kingdom in the struggle against Assyrian power. As they told their story, they thought, yeah, well, we got out of Egypt. God got us out of Egypt. God can get us away from Assyria or Babylon. The prophets certainly used it in their critique of the abuses of the government and life which they opposed in the name of Yahweh. And we're not going to do it now, but Book of Amos and Isaiah keep referring back to, look what your ancestors did and look what God did then. And why are your leaders now becoming rich, enslaving their own people and joining up with Assyria? They should be following Yahweh and caring for the poor and so on and so on. God knows what the prophets would be saying today in Israel, and there are many prophets in Israel now who are not happy with the way other people are being oppressed in their land. Some parts of the story may have been written prior to the destruction of Samaria, which was 721, 500 years after Moses. Here's from the book of Deuteronomy. You shall say to your children, we were Pharaoh's slaves in Egypt, but Yahweh brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand. Yahweh displayed before our eyes great and awesome signs and wonders against Egypt, against Pharaoh and all his household. He brought us out from there in order to bring us in to give us the land which he promised on oath to our ancestors. Beautifully recapturing in story form, legend form, the identity of us as a new people in this world. The Exodus story supported Joshua's movement to reconquer and liberate the promised land. Josiah was king in the 600s. He was pretty well the last king. There was a couple after him for a short time. Then there was the destruction of Jerusalem. And Josiah was a wonderful king, and he was determined to recapture the whole of the north and rebuild what he'd heard was the kingdom of David. It probably is much bigger than the kingdom of David, but leave that aside. That's what he was going to do. So when the story was told about what God did to our ancestors, that encouraged them to think God will do it for us too. You can see that. The Exodus story inspired those living in exile in Babylon. It inspired them to return to the promised land. Just imagine, you know all about the Babylonian exile, I'm sure. So put yourself in the Babylonian exile, which is like the Egyptian exile. And telling this story, they thought, yeah. And then when Cyrus came, and he was a Persian, but he had a whole different idea, and he was letting people go back to their own land and have their own religion and build their own temples, so different from the Babylonians. Well, they were hoping he's going to do it for us too in Babylon. And he did. And so they wanted to go back, like their ancestors under Moses, go back across the desert, now coming from the east, of course, across the desert and rebuild this land for God. This story, this big story of Moses bringing God's instrument in coming from slavery in Egypt to the promised land, It inspired the post-exilic community attempting to form a renewed Israel and recalling the experiences of their beginnings, determined to be faithful to the covenant with God made in their name by their ancestors, a covenant which defines them as a people. So again and again and again, this big story of the Exodus is inspiring generation after generation to listen to God through the prophets and to build a community that is faithful to Yahweh's will. Ezra and Nehemiah belong to the middle of the 5th century BC, so 100 years or so after the return from exile. And in the book of Nehemiah, we read this. So 450 BC now. Ezra proclaimed, Ezra the priest from Babylon, Yahweh, you saw the distress of our ancestors. And this is typical. They would have heard this kind of sermon often. Yahweh, you saw the distress of our ancestors in Egypt. You heard their cry at the Red Sea. You performed signs and wonders against Pharaoh and all his servants and all the people of his land, for you knew that they acted insolently against our ancestors. You made a name for yourself, which remains to this day. And you, he's talking to God, you divided the sea before them so that they passed through the sea on dry land. But you threw their pursuers into the depths like a stone into mighty waters. Keep in mind, this is 800 years, this speech, after the story, the original story. So it's still echoing. You divided the sea, etc. Moreover, you led them by day with a pillar of cloud and by night with a pillar of fire to give them light on the way in which they should go. You came down upon them upon Mount Sinai. You spoke with them from heaven. You gave them right ordinances and true laws, good statutes and commandments. And you made known your holy Sabbath to them and gave them commandments and statutes and a law through your servant Moses. It's like us in Easter week talking about the crucifixion and the resurrection of Jesus and how important it is to our identity. Well, they're looking back to this Exodus. And he continues, for their hunger you gave them bread from heaven. For their thirst you brought water for them out of the rock. You told them to go in to possess the land that you swore to give them. You are a God ready to forgive, gracious, merciful, slow to anger, abounding in steadfast love. And you didn't forsake them, even when they cast an image of a calf for themselves. You, in your great mercies, did not forsake them in the wilderness. The pillar of cloud that led them in the way did not leave them by day, nor the pillar of fire by night that gave them light on the way by which they should go. You gave your good spirit to instruct them and did not withhold your manna from their mouths. You gave them water for their thirst. 40 years you sustained them in the wilderness so that they lacked nothing. Their clothes did not wear out and their feet did not swell. He's getting carried away with his homily. But you can see what he's doing. He's drawing on a story that's been told for 800 years and it's still echoing for them and of course still is today. Now, we need to come to the end. Besides narrative, that is story, Exodus is a handbook for religious festivals. It's a code of law as well. This material is mainly contributed by the priestly school. There were different groups, like you might have different religious orders today or different East and West in the church, or you might have different groupings. Well, here they had different schools with different interests and they had to kind of interact, and then they'd argue in the synagogue and no, and then they'd end up with a text that we've got which they'd all kind of agree to, like the Second Vatican Council document, some reluctantly agreeing, some really keen. And if you read these Second Vatican Council documents really carefully, you can support any opinion you like, really. There is a thrust in them that's beautiful and wonderful and liberating, but there's a lot of balks in it too, because some of the other cardinals at the time didn't like what was going on, so they had their bit in there too, and so you get every now and then they can quote a little bit. The sweep of it is still there. Well, that's what happened in the Bible too. Well, the priestly school are obviously interested in law, code and festivals. So they're the ones mainly responsible for those bits. It's important that we read these laws as expressions of practices that have come down through the tradition. A tradition which they understood to be guided by Yahweh. So they all begin with Yahweh said. Well, who knows what Yahweh said back then? But we've got these traditions and they're sacred, so they're in God's name, so God is brought in to support the priestly traditions that they're now inheriting and insisting on. These laws express ways in which their ancestors and they themselves have solved various problems that have emerged in the community, as well as ways of organizing personal and communal life in ways that are consistent with their religious insights. So God didn't give Moses on the mountain all the rituals forever. It's going to look like that when you read it, but obviously that didn't happen. It wouldn't make any sense to anybody. What they do is, with all their rituals that have grown up and organized life, and then something else happened and then a problem arose, can women inherit land? They never could before, but then they said, oh, so there's a bit about that, and there's a bit about something else, and what do we do with foreigners who are living in our land? How do we treat them? They're not Israelites, but they're here. What do we do with them? So you have laws about that in the Bible, I mean. So what they do is they grab all these laws, and Mount Sinai, God gives them all. The whole of the book of Leviticus happens within a week, just before they leave and head off into the desert. Well, none of it even existed at that time, of course. It made no sense then. But that's what they do with it. They put it there. We're invited to see the continuing activity of God in each new present, our present too, by recalling those events in the past that have proven themselves to be of revelatory power. This is expressed well in a speech placed on the lips of Moses by the writers of the book of Deuteronomy. And Deuteronomy 5:3 reads, Yahweh our God made a covenant with us at Horeb, that means the wilderness mountain, Sinai in other traditions, not with our fathers,